From deep inside the Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
I'm Gov Maharaj.
And welcome to Defrag. Gov, I thought we were dressing up for Halloween. It's a Halloween show.
What are you talking about? I am dressed up.
You dressed as Gov this year?
Yeah, scary, isn't it?
It's a little scary. It depends. All right, well, I'm glad I didn't dress up, so... All right, so first question today. Ronnie Swafford commented on the show last week. He said the DisplayPort adapters, and so we're talking about using iFinity on ATI cards being able to group all your monitors as one monitor. And he says the DisplayPort adapters work fine as long as they're active adapters. I'm running five monitors, good Lord, with Dell Precision M laptop using adapters. Yeah, I've read online that...
The active adapters are definitely better.
Yeah, the active adapters work better. I have not tried that. I mentioned last time I had some problems. I ordered a couple of the passive ones that were supposed to work, and I haven't had much luck with those until I used a monitor. It actually had DisplayPort on it. Yeah, an active adapter. Now, guess what I'm going to have to do this weekend? Go to Fry's, go find some... All right, well, thanks for that that info, and now I'm going to have to go find some active adapters. Cool. Dentaku said, Zed is the way most of the world says it. Z is an American fabrication. I imagine you agree.
I tend to agree, yeah.
I just think it's interesting he has to spell Zed with three letters, and I spell Z with one, but... All right, so WinDev says the reverse of Windows M, Minimize All, is actually Windows Shift M. It restores the Windows Minimize via Windows M and nothing else. I did not know that. This is the beauty of crowdsourcing tech support, as I've never tried that before. You ever heard of that before?
Well, Shift does tend to be the opposite of most things, like Alt-Tab, Shift-Alt-Tab will cycle through in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
So it makes sense.
It does.
I suppose, though, you know, if you get an effect from WinKey M and you hit it again and it just reverses it as well,
yeah,
you kind of just stick to using WinKey M and tend to forget about the alternative.
Lots of options here. We're going to give you a lot of options today. So there you go. That's one of the things you can try. So Ian Trelevin wrote, I've tried using ReadyBoost on SD cards on a few laptops, but it seems pretty unreliable. After sleep, the laptop will frequently not even know there's an SD card in the slot, and when it does, Windows 7 will often not remember that it is using the card as a ReadyBoost device. Is this an issue with SD card readers? We mentioned this in a previous show that with SD card readers, it might not work.
It's actually kind of funny because I've had this exact same problem on a number of different machines. And what tended to happen is it's really motherboard and OEM dependent. You know, you get a BIOS update that would actually make this better. It would, after coming back from sleep, it would initialize faster. And instead of, you know, reading it just as an SD card, the SD bus would actually come up faster, enumerated, and then presented to the system as, yes, everything is ready. Now use me as SD as it was before.
Yeah.
Or as ReadyBoost as it was before. You can use SD cards. I remember way back in...
Sometimes.
Sometimes. It really does depend on your computer manufacturer.
Yeah, mileage may vary, so test it out and see.
But even some USB keys, you know, some of them work, some of them don't.
Yeah. And normally, I mean, one of the problems that you'll have most frequently with a USB key not working is just not fast enough. There's certifications and things for ReadyBoost thumb drive, so if you're going to go buy a thumb drive for that...
Yeah, there's a test that Windows itself performs when you plug it in. Every single time it says, is this ready for ReadyBoost? And then it gives you the option.
Yeah. But if you're going out in the store, you might want to look for that on the package to see if that's going to be a drive that's going to support that. Hey, to go get a new thumb drive and then it doesn't do ReadyBoost, and that's the only reason you bought it.
Right. I did have a link about ReadyBoost and, you know, what it actually does to help speed up the system, how, you know, even if you have a flash drive or
SSD.
An SSD, thank you. That it will still potentially help.
Yeah.
You won't see as much benefit as you would with a rotational drive.
Yeah.
But, you know, all it really is saying, you know, instead of having to hit the disk, you know, you've hit RAM, it's not in RAM.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of having to go and hit the disk, here's another intermediate that might have the information that you're looking for that is still going to be faster than a rotational drive.
So with ReadyBoost, tell us what types of scenarios and systems are you going to have the best bang for the buck on a ReadyBoost drive?
A lot of, you know, read-ahead sequentials, I've found, you know, some big perf improvements with using it for Photoshop. Although people have been, you know, working around those types of issues on their own for a long time by having Photoshop, say, saved to a specific scratch disk.
Yeah.
You could potentially use a USB drive for that purpose if it was fast enough. But it, you know, database access, a lot of caching can help there.
Mm-hmm.
On my Media Center machine, for example, I use ReadyBoost drives with the Media Browser plugin.
Yeah.
And it actually takes advantage of that rather well.
Mm-hmm.
So I found things to be significantly faster on those low-end HTPCs for improving perf.
And so on a ReadyBoost drive, it'll only use a certain amount of a drive. So does it make sense to get a ReadyBoost thumb drive that's like 8 gig, 16 gig?
So the system will use up to 4 gig of the drive,
mm-hmm.
and then you can use the rest of the drive however you see fit.
So that's one of the things I was wondering. Can I still use it like an external drive to copy stuff
to? So if you had an 8 gig key, for example, it'll dedicate 4 gig from that key. But you can also have multiple keys if you actually
really?
Want. Yeah. Windows 7 actually takes advantage of that. Vista did not.
You
could only use one key.
Nice, nice. Awesome. Cool. Okay, well, there you have it. All right, next question. Is there a way to remove Show Desktop button next to the clock in Windows 7?
He's talking about this thing right here.
Yeah, so it's that thing. And one of the things I've noticed with this when I'm at home is sometimes I'll hit my mouse and it goes down in the corner and it makes the windows, you know, kind of see-through, transparent.
Yep.
So is there a way to disable that?
There is not a built-in way to disable it. We actually found through a lot of, you know, user experience testing that actually having that little button way down in the corner was the right thing to do. It is innocuous. So for the vast majority of people, it should not actually be interfering.
Yeah.
There are definitely scenarios, you know, multi-monitor machines where if you have your taskbar set and you have another monitor on this, on an adjacent side, where you're more likely to go across the monitors,
mm-hmm.
That could potentially get in the way. There are some third-party utilities that we don't support, but there's a lot of things that third parties do to extend the system, and we're not stopping them from doing it.
Yeah, so
but
we're not going to start pointing out what to use, but you can do a pretty simple Bing search.
Yep.
And you can find something that will do that for you if that's what you want to do.
Yep.
I really like it. I mean, I use it a lot. It's even good if you've got a lot of emails up on the screen like I tend to do and someone walks into your office, you can just throw your mouse and, you know, it makes everything transparent. And
the boss key.
Yeah, well, boss directs, whoever you don't want to see things. And the other tip that I have, too, that sometimes it's kind of hard to hit if you have multi-monitors.
Yes.
Is I go into the, I right-click on a desktop, go into the monitor setup, and I'll take the right monitor and move it up just a little bit. So it gives me a corner to kind of latch onto for that. So
that's a really good idea, you know, especially if you have really large resolution monitors where you're not actually having to do a lot of dragging. Like on my system at work, I've got four monitors, and I tend to actually dedicate applications windows to particular monitors.
Yeah.
Like my email is dedicated to a monitor, and it's, you know, off to the side but always running, and I don't tend to move that around a lot.
Yeah.
So if you're not tending to move around your applications a lot, you know, you start them up, they go to a particular monitor, and they kind of sit there.
Yeah.
That's actually a really good thing, you know, to if you're having hotspots on your monitor, if you just, like, throw it up to a corner if you're trying to close an app, you don't constantly want to drag it away from the other monitor.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. Next question. I just have the note, Charles' sister's router problem. So this is one, Charles Torrey, his sister, had a problem with her router.
Mm-hmm.
And
what
the
kind was it?
It was a Apple AirPort router. And the problem was that she got a new Windows 7 laptop, booted it up, tried to get it on the connected to the router,
mm-hmm.
and it said, enter your PIN, and she put in her password for her router, and it didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of identified that one right away because he said, you know, enter the PIN.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is that it was defaulting to enter the PIN that's on the bottom of the router for the security. And there's actually a link on that toast a little bit lower that says use, you know, the access key, which is the password that you'd normally use on a router.
Mm-hmm.
So if you click that, it gives you the old dialog where you can type in your password and they'll take care of that. But there's another way, too. You were talking about the button that's on routers, too.
Yes, that's the WPS, the Wireless Protection Services, I don't quite know what the S stands for, but it's wireless protection. It's an easy way to connect to a router from a new machine. You just press a button on your router, your machine discovers it and says, oh, I now need to talk to a new router, and you get to just pair it.
Yeah. Easy. All right. Nice. Okay, so next question. I currently have Windows 7 installed on C of a 20 gig capacity drive. When I run some heavy software like 3D Max, Photoshop, I face low disk space problems. Plan to buy a new hard drive. What's the best way to copy over to the new hard drive? They heard Acronis Migrate Easy can do it in a better way, but they're worried about, you know, is it safe to do this? Are they going to have problems with this? This is a simple answer. We get this one quite a bit.
Yeah, backup and restore.
Yeah.
This is what I would do. I would either back up the entire drive or just back up the data and clean install the OS fresh on the drive. There's a lot of advantages to this, you know, depending on how long he's had the system, how long it's been running. You can just tend to accumulate cruft.
Yeah.
It's a new word.
I haven't heard that before.
Cruft,
yeah.
Detritus, goo. I tend to like to, if I'm going to all the trouble of yanking out the drive, putting in a new one, you know, I'm getting some serious downtime.
Yeah.
I'd like to start from scratch.
It's a breath of fresh air, dude.
It is. And you get to take stock of your system and say, well, you know, I had a 20 gig drive. What did I actually have installed? What did I use?
Yeah.
You know, can I get updates for the stuff that I'm doing right now? You know, nowadays, Windows setup, I mean, I can easily take from bare system to fully up and running in an hour and a half.
There's not that much difference between flattening a machine and doing a backup and restore and copying stuff.
Yep.
And you get a lot of benefits. Now, the one caveat for this, the one place where you might not want to do this, is if you have a bunch of apps, a bunch of settings and things that you just don't have the disks for, you don't want to reinstall, you don't want to bother with it, that might be a place where you just want to use backup instead.
Absolutely.
But I would say 99% of the time, if you can, just flatten.
But, you know, for ease of use, if, you know, you're just a regular user that's going out to Fry's, Best Buy, whatever, to buy a new drive, maybe you don't feel the need to want to go through all that hassle, or, you know, maybe you have an OEM machine and they haven't given you the install disk. That one is actually, in that particular case, you'd want to back up your data with the easy Windows Easy Transfer, WET, and then put in your new disk, and then use the restore DVD that your OEM gives you, and just blast it right back on.
Yeah.
Now I'm hoping that our audience actually has, you know, media of some sort to fresh install their OS.
Yeah, cool. All right, next question. So I have some Real Player video files in a folder. Windows 7 by default makes a folder show up with album name, artist name, track title, stuff like that, folder for songs. Is there a way to make all the folders behave the same, just show file name, size, type, so a typical details view?
Absolutely there is. So what I would do is, you know, go to whatever folder that this content is in. You can right-click on it, you go to Properties, you go to Customize, and you can just customize it to General Items. And then you can apply that to all subfolders. And if you do that at, you know, a parent folder, you can just say, you know, do that on C, and then you're basically done. You know, as long as you have rights to the folders within them. You can, you know, restore defaults, which is good. You can, you know, if you change your mind, you like the old method better, you can reapply the old templates.
Yeah. Awesome. Easy. Easy is eating lettuce. All right, next question. I need a standard or limited Windows 7 user to be able to run an application, Fallout Mod Manager, which requires UAC elevation. I've tried Application Compatibility Toolkit, but did not work as intended. Any suggestions? I'm running Windows 7 Ultimate local, so policies can be applied.
So that answer, or the question, has multiple parts to it. You kind of have to ask yourself, well, why is it being elevated? There's a couple of different reasons why it could be elevated. The app itself has requested elevation. So what I want to do, if I can real quick, is... I want to show you what a manifest file looks like.
Okay.
So here we would pick up something like regedit, because I know that one has a manifest. The app that I'm using is ResHacker. A lot of people should know what that is. Mm-hmm. Allows you to see resources in XE's DLLs.
Yeah.
So this is the important part of what I wanted to talk about. I don't think I've got a zoom level in here. No. Anyways, so you want to look for the...
Windows Plus. Do Windows Plus, man.
Windows. I don't know if that'll work in this one. No.
No? All right.
No. Oh, magnifier. That'll do it. So as you can see here, the manifest that I'm looking at is talking about a requested execution level, and it's marked as highest available. Now, a lot of applications will mark themselves as require administrator. That's what causes the UAC prompt. Another way to mark them is as invoker, which does not do a UAC prompt. It just runs the application without elevated privileges. The highest available, what that one does is if you're in the administrator group, it will prompt for elevation. If you're a standard user, it won't prompt for elevation.
Okay.
So this is just one method for an application to say, I require administrative privileges.
Yeah.
If that's the case, what you can do is get the AppCompat toolkit, and there is a shim there that you can say, run as invoker. Mm-hmm. So you can actually force it, or you can use ResHacker, depending on whether or not the app is signed. You can say remove this manifest entirely, and it will either not prompt or it could still prompt, because we also have heuristics in the OS that try to figure out the right thing to do with an application. If we think that it requires elevation, we're going to make it prompt for elevation.
Yeah.
So back to the original question. So what he wants is that this app is currently asking for administrator privileges, but he wants it so that the standard user can run it.
Yeah.
So if it is upfront prompting, the only way to turn that off is to either remove this manifest, change the manifest, use the shim run as invoker to force it to not prompt. It will, however, not automatically run with administrator privileges without the prompt. All it'll do is say, okay, I'm not running with admin privileges.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when that happens, you kind of have to ask yourself, why is it needing to run with admin privileges? What is it doing? Most of the time, and what I would guess from this mod manager, is that it's modifying resource files, image files for Fallout, and is doing it by modifying the files in program files.
Yeah.
So what I would do is remove this marking if it's asking for elevation, or run it with the layer, and then change the permissions on the change the permissions on the folder itself. So if you go to the program files, say you know, it was the Microsoft link folder, you know, you find the folder that it was trying to modify. Normally, regular users, can't touch that folder. They can't write to anything in that folder.
Mm-hmm.
But you can just right-click on it, go to Properties, go to Security, and then as an administrator user, you can add the user that you are trying to run as a standard user, give them write permissions to that directory, and then everything should just work. So the app is no longer going to request elevation. The user has rights to write to that directory, so the app should just function.
And what if you installed the Fallout in a different directory, like C games? Would that even be an option, or would it be a problem then? Or
it shouldn't be a problem then, because we wouldn't have restricted the rights. Now, the installation program could easily restrict the rights.
Yeah.
So what you're trying to do is figure out what it is that is causing the failure for a standard user.
Yeah.
Now, it's either trying to write to a file, maybe writing to a registry key. There are a couple of tools that you can use to help figure out what it is that is actually causing this issue. And you go to trusty Bing. We've developed some tools, but there's one that I really, really like. It's called Lua Buglight, written by a good friend, Aaron Margosis. His blog talks about it. This his tool will run with an app and say, you know, why is this actually asking, what is it doing such that it requires admin privileges? What is it writing to? What is it trying to open? And it gives you this nice report.
Cool.
So this is an absolutely fundamental tool if you want to figure out what an app is doing with respect to UAC and how to redesign your app so it doesn't require it.
Nice. Awesome. All right. Cool. Next question. Can I hide a user account from Windows 7 welcome screen without changing registry manually and without disabling the account?
You can, but you do actually have to edit the registry.
Yeah.
I thought I had that window here.
The TechnicsUpdate.com.
I don't know what happened to that one.
You could do a search for hide remove user account on Windows 7 welcome screen.
Yeah, there it is. I knew I'd searched for it.
So here you go. Here's the steps for this. You want to walk us through this a little bit?
Yeah, actually, I'd forget about the don't display last name one.
Yeah.
That one probably won't do what you wanted to do. You actually do want to use this other registry key, and actually now I remember what I did. I actually put it into...
Oh, yeah. That's for the next question.
That's for the next question.
Okay.
I put it into Notepad so that we could show it to you. And that's going to come up in our next follow-up question.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
We've got to love our prep.
Yeah.
This is Defrag Unplugged.
Yeah. But this will walk you through all the steps here. It looks like it's pretty cut and dry.
Yeah,
and
it's really straightforward. You just add the username to the list to not to show.
Yeah. And you can still log in. You still log in the same. You can just type the name in.
What you'd really want to do is, because it won't show on the welcome screen, there's nothing to actually click on.
Mm-hmm.
So you can still connect to it via remote desktop, though.
Yeah. Oh, cool. Okay. Nice. All right. Next question. Is there software for Windows 7 which can show a computer's energy usage in real time? I'm currently using Battery Barge, gives an estimated discharge rate, but essentially an average of the decrease in battery power over a given time. So let's talk about this a little bit. You'd have to have some hardware support for it to be accurate.
Right. So what I believe you'd fundamentally need is support from the motherboard manufacturer, the OEM, in order to give this information
accurately.
As opposed to us having to pull for it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is really a sliding scale, and especially with the current chips that are like Intel chips that run SpeedStep, you know, they're constantly changing what their performance is based on the current workload. So at any given time, it's totally different, and how much energy it's using is going to be totally different.
So there's also Microsoft Research has a Joule meter.
Yeah, you told me about this one.
This is one I got from Charles Torrey. So this is some software that'll it's another estimate power usage. But if you really want to do this and you want to be specific about exactly how much power you're using, you should use a device. And there's a lot of different things. You can do a search. I think Newegg has them. Is it kilowatt?
There's kilowatt. The problem with kilowatt, though, and I just realized this, is in terms of energy usage, if you're on a laptop with a battery, it may not actually give you accurate energy usage, right? Because it's pulling power from a battery.
Sure. You take your battery out.
You take your battery out, yeah. Apparently, with the Joule meter, there's another piece of hardware you can get, this WhatsApp Pro with USB connection. So this apparently works well with the Joule meter software.
Yeah, nice. And one of the other things, too, that you can use with kilowatt is even if you use software and even if it's accurate, that might just be my desktop box. It doesn't include my system, which could be my powered USB hub, my external drives, my monitor, and stuff like that. So if you use kilowatt, you could use a power strip,
just
plug
into
the kilowatt, plug all your stuff that you use on your typical system into that, and then you can get an idea of your full system. So, and the nice thing with kilowatt, too, is you can stick it on anything in your house. You can get an idea of what other power consumption you have on other devices.
I know I've bought this device, and I've used it to compare my HTPC, for example, versus my original DVR from my cable company.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah, I actually get better power usage out of my HTPC than I do out of the cable box.
So you should bring it in because one of the things that I want to try out is, you know, the pads that you set devices on that charges
wirelessly? Yep.
I want to see how much more power do you lose from having it kind of go through the air or radiate rather than if you just plugged it up directly.
Well, so, the induction power.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be actually a pretty interesting test.
Okay, cool. We need more budget. We're going to have to try that out. All right, next question. Let's see. Every tool that I've tried, this is a question about three terabyte drives. Every tool that they've tried, Robocopy, MS Sync Toy, PowerSync, and they name a bunch of others, don't seem to work for these really big drives. Mm-hmm. What's your thoughts on that? We haven't tested this.
We haven't tested this kind of because, you know, greater than 3 terabyte drives have been difficult to test mm-hmm. until relatively recently.
Yeah.
We just haven't had to deal with that kind of drive space as a single volume.
Can you think of anything that might prevent that from working? And
is really just the software, right? It's,
yeah.
It's they have not taken into account that 3 terabytes is a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with Robocopy. It's said, you know, its general volume limit is going to be 2 terabytes because
yeah.
that's all that we had to test with. So really you just need to either do it manually through scripts where it's not, you know, Robocopy all on its own, but perhaps, you know, PowerShell breaking it down into smaller steps.
Mm-hmm.
To actually do the mirroring.
What about just partitioning the drive into 2 drives? I mean,
that's always a possibility. I know a lot of folks don't like doing
thing.
It.
Yeah, but I mean, at least if you have a process that you need to follow,
sure,
it would at least let you go back to that. Cool. All right. So this was the next question that we were talking about with your notepad here. I have a program that's stuck under my taskbar in Windows 7. I can't click on it because it's being interpreted as a taskbar click and not on the program. How can I recover that? So there's a bunch of different ways to do that. We're going to walk through a bunch of them now. What would be your preferred way?
I particularly like this method. You unlock the taskbar, and then you drag it away.
Yeah, yeah, and that's going to restore it to some degree. So
that's,
you can,
that's going to restore it to some degree and, you know, be able to pull it back.
Okay.
That's kind of the most direct method that I came up with. Well, obviously not on my own, but it's one that I've used for
and you
misbehaving.
You had another one that I didn't know about, but it used to be that you could right-click on the taskbar icon
but
and
now
it
you
would
get this.
Show you things. But yeah, but now you get this, which is cool, but how do you get the old one?
As with many things, the keyboard helps people use their mouse.
The shift modifier.
Very funny, the shift modifier. You can right-click on it, and you get back the old dialog, the old menu.
Old school upper left-hand corner menu.
You can maximize it. You can just choose move and then use your arrow keys to bring it back.
And so that was the first way that I tried this. That's the method that I use, but I don't use the shift click on that. If you put it back, the thing that I always do is I do alt space M, which I just know is going to trigger that exact same dialog on an app. So I do alt space M, which
alt
will do that dialog box,
M.
and then just use the arrow keys or,
yep.
you know, that kind of thing. The other thing that you could do, too, is you could right-click on your taskbar, bring up the task manager,
mm-hmm.
find the window that you want, right-click on it, do maximize. Now, if you do that and then you go to something else, it minimizes back to where it was. But if while it's maximized, you can grab the title bar
and then
pull it around, and then it's going to be fine, too. So, again, lots of different ways to do the same thing. But
apparently, over the years, people have lost their Windows, and depending on who solves that particular bug at the time says, I'm going to come up with another way of solving it.
Yeah, it's funny, too, because I read the question, and I was like, huh, let me try this out. And I had our prep notes for this show in an email that I was getting ready to write to you and send to you. And I almost lost the prep notes because an email window dialog doesn't have the alt space menu that apps do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when I found that if I unlocked my taskbar and moved it around, it'd do that. But I was worried there for a minute that I was going to lose our show notes. So yeah, but there's so many different ways to do the same thing.
The nice thing with the alt space M is that you can actually have windows that are completely off screen where there is nothing to, like, even if you move the taskbar, you're still not going to find it.
Yeah.
But at least if you do that and you kind of know which side of the screen it might be on, you just use your arrow keys and just keep, you know, bringing it one way or the other.
Yeah. Yeah, and alt space M, I mean, if you have your hands on the keyboard, it's a really easy way. You don't have to reach for the mouse. So you can minimize windows, you can maximize windows, you can restore, and it's just like that. That's just a fast way. So it's a good shortcut to know. All right, so we're at pick of the week. Pick of the week. And we got two of them today that we want to talk about. The first one is a very cool one that's a Battlefield 3 simulator. It's a video that's going around. And yeah, go ahead and play that. So it's an interesting method for playing Battlefield 3 that uses kind of a virtual environment. I don't know. I need more information on this. There's so much missing. I guess we have to watch this to watch the show to find out more about this. But I question, like, how's that floor work? What is that center circle in the middle? How does it track the device? Is that going to work for everyone in that game, or is it specific to this setup?
It is a rather complicated setup, too.
It is.
I mean, think of the sheer room that is required for
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah. And I recently saw there was a Discovery show with Michio Kaku who talked about trying to make a holodeck, a real holodeck.
Mm-hmm.
And he showed a floor that DARPA, I think it was DARPA that was working on, where they had some rolling things that you stepped on. And it was not this good, which that's why I'm kind of wondering how come DARPA wasn't using this setup, because theirs, they had to tie the guy onto the ceiling to keep him from falling over.
Right.
It was just kind of haphazard. So interesting to see this. I need more information. Also, when the guy gets hit in the video, he's like, ah, so I'm wondering about that. We did an interview on Channel 10 back in the day with a company that's right down the street, and they make these vests that you put on. It uses an air compressor. It kind of thumps you like that, but...
Wow.
Not sure what the method is here, but yeah, it needs more information.
Maybe some sort of electrical shock.
Yeah, that's see, that would be the cool thing. You have a little Arduino board, and it just kind of shocks you in the right place, because that's going to hurt a little bit more in a little thump.
Although, I suppose some people might like it too much.
Yeah, but the biggest problem with this is I can't have this in my house, because I don't have enough space.
Right.
So we were talking before the show, what are some other interesting ways that you could do the same thing? And I would say, and I mentioned this on a Ping show not too long ago, is I like the new Sony head-mounted display. I think it's called the HMZ.
Mm-hmm.
It's 720p, so it's high resolution, and it's going to let you be in one space. It doesn't, you know, you don't have the floor that you have in this one,
mm-hmm.
but it's. I think it would be a better experience for looking around, because, you know, if you look at the floor in this, you see the floor. If you look at the floor with the head-mounted display,
mm-hmm.
you'll see ground. The problem with the HMZ is it doesn't have tracking, head tracking on it. But then I thought, you know, you just take an IR band and then have Kinect figure that out for you. So it knows where you're looking and how to adjust the picture that it's sending to you.
Mm-hmm.
And you could also be able to see your hands and stuff like that in the game, virtual hands and arms and weapon, because, you know, Kinect can see those things. So that's an option.
That's the great thing about the Kinect is, like, really the possibilities are endless on
yeah.
that. And we've had so many external hackers that have taken, you know, the Kinect and the Kinect SDK,
yeah,
and just made some phenomenal devices. You know, things that it's like, wow, why didn't we think of that kind of thing? Or, you know, this is going to help so many other people.
Yeah.
I mean, the Kinect as a technology is rather impressive for what a small device can do. With the sheer programming power behind it, the SDK,
yeah,
you know, it's simplistic and yet so powerful.
Yeah, and then there was another thing. If you bring up your picture, there was something that I came up with a couple years ago, where I was like, this might be good for like kind of mobile, and I called it War Hero, which is kind of like Guitar Hero only. yeah, so the idea was to put some kind of slate device on a gun. And then you use the sensors in the slate to tell where you're aiming and stuff like that.
Oh, the gyroscope, yeah.
Yeah, and then you use all the actual devices on the fake weapon. So you like trigger, charging handle, the M203 grenade launcher, because you have to have a grenade launcher, and stuff like that. So lots of ideas there. Can't wait to see what people flesh out with these. So good ideas. Keep run with them.
I like this one. I like this one a lot.
Yeah, and take the screen off might even work with Kinect. That'd be an interesting concept too. So
mm-hmm.
lots of ideas there. So that's the show for this week. If you have any questions, you can email us at defragshow@microsoft.com, and you can leave comments on the webpage or send us an email so we can get back to you. Thanks for watching.
Thanks.